This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome. The good news is a podcast is here. The bad news is
it's
Junk Food Cinema. That's right, folks. This is the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast right here on filmschoolrejects.com that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host, novelist slash screenwriter, co-writer of Doctor Strange, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
You forgot Lieutenant in Megaforce.
Lieutenant of Mega Strange. Dr. Cargill, what is happening? I don't know.
Yeah, nobody knows.
All the notes got mixed up. Much like this movie is a weird mix-em-up of a lot of various references and genres and influences, but we'll get to that in just a moment. I want to remind you guys that this show is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher, and if you like what you hear, you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. So today's film is one that I have been excited to talk about for a very long time. It is one of those quintessential discoveries, one of those movies that I, before moving to Austin, knew absolutely nothing about, had no idea existed. And as much as I kind of considered myself a film plebe when I moved here, I think in my defense, for a long time, just before I moved here, this was a movie that was very difficult to track down and get one's hands on. This was not a film that initially made the leap from VHS to DVD. This is an 80s gem of a horror film by the name of Night of the Creeps.
From a world unknown comes a nightmare unimagined. First, they are under you, around you, on you, and then inside you.
They get in through your mouth, and you walk around while they incubate, even if you're dead.
They are a new breed of terror.
Night of the Creeps is a film that shortly after I moved here actually got a special edition DVD and Blu-ray released. It was directed by a gentleman by the name of Fred Decker, who is an interesting case study in the unforgiving nature of the Hollywood machine, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, Fred Decker's a very interesting case. And also one of those guys in the junk food pantheon for having been responsible for a number of films that we each have our own, you know, personal connections to.
Sure.
This being one of them. Another, of course, being one that everyone out there in junk food land should know, one that we've refrained from talking about simply because it's one of those that we assume you've already seen, Monster Squad, which is such a great, great movie if you, for some reason, haven't seen it. And then, of course, he was responsible for writing the story for House.
Yes.
Which I'm a big fan of and desperately want William Katt's V-neck sweater, although my wife has claimed she'll divorce me if I ever show up with his plunging V-neck sweater from House.
I have three words for you. Call her bluff. Call her bluff, Cargill. You get yourself that sweater. I know how important sweaters are to you. I've seen Sinister, so I know how sweaters are a factor in your creative process.
But could you just imagine Ethan Hawke in a plunging V-neck instead of a cardigan?
Oh, I do every night when I close my eyes, Cargill.
Oh, that's what we should have done. We should have used William Katt's plunging V-neck. That would have been so awesome. Oh, my God. No, but the thing is Fred Decker made some really great stuff in a very small window of time.
True.
And then got was attached to direct a third movie in a pretty good fucking series that was right up his alley, and that movie was RoboCop 3.
Yeah, but it's like you can think of so many analogs to that in our current time where you have these directors who are known for making these small genre films that get a lot of love from their audiences, and then they get called up to do that big movie, and it blows up in their face. Like, we've seen that happen a number of times, even even now. And it's just really, it's so sad, though, because between Monster Squad and this film, Night of the Creeps, Fred Dekker was really establishing himself as a new and exciting voice in genre filmmaking, even as he was culling so much from the things that have inspired him, that to the point that in this film, there are almost every character is named after one of his influences.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. What's particularly interesting about this film and his career is he was a nostalgia filmmaker.
Absolutely.
And it's such a weird thing that here we are in the year 2016, looking back 30 years to the year 1986 to nostalgically drink in a film that is nostalgically looking back 30 years into the 50s and riffing on all of the movies that he loved that came from that era.
Yeah.
This movie, as we talked about before the show, is riffing on one movie in particular.
Oh, absolutely.
And this is a movie that is not only referencing the thing it's riffing on, the more you know about the thing it's riffing on and the genre that he's playing around with, this entire movie is kind of a farce on those kind of movies, in the same way that movies like Hatchet, Adam Green's Hatchet, is a farce on the movies of the 80s.
Sure.
And this movie's full of it. Like, there's stuff that doesn't make any fucking sense unless you know terrible 50s genre films.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. Like, this movie is his love letter, and it's something I've always been fascinated with. This particular window of time in the 80s was such a nostalgic time, where we had all these filmmakers who were being nostalgic for the stuff they grew up with. And then that became uncool and went away and just recently came back with the advent of kind of the geek uprising, and is starting to get to the point where people are getting done with nostalgia now, and they're starting to move on. So we're kind of at the end of the nostalgia swing. And yet you and I will never, ever be at the end of the nostalgia swing. Like a guy who still drives around in a 57 Chevy, wearing glasses and a long beard, we are going to be those guys always, always.
Or a
always.
Guy who has an entire wall full of VHS tapes long after VHS is a dead format.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't know. I'm just hipster. Looking behind you.
And what did you buy on vinyl recently, my friend?
Yeah.
You don't want to answer that because there actually is an answer.
No, there is. There is. There's very
did you buy
much
the Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan soundtrack on vinyl?
No, but this week I will be buying the Your Next soundtrack on vinyl because holy hell. Anyway, this film, Night of the Creeps, if you're not familiar with the movie, let me give you a breakdown of the plot. You have, at the beginning of the film, you have these aliens, one of whom has clearly stolen something, is being pursued by other aliens on a spaceship. He loads his purloined discovery into the escape pod and sends it down to Earth. It turns out that that pod crashes right into the middle of Rush Week 1959 at Corman University.
That's
hint
so weird.
Number one. Hint number one as to what the influences may be.
We're actually in this sequence. Here's the weird dichotomy in this movie. We open with a sequence that would only exist in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like, it is these big puppy aliens running through a cheesy alien spaceship, firing lasers at each other. We don't know what's going on. The aliens are speaking. They're being subtitled both in their own language and in our language. And it's so very 80s.
Very much. We
blast this thing off into space, and then we pan down onto Earth in 1959, and we are smack dab in the middle of a cheesy 50s horror movie. Like, this has all the hallmarks. It is so cliche in terms of, like, and it's deliberately so. Right down to there's this moment when, you know, because we're getting all of our news through the radio, and the only thing we're hearing on the radio is the local sanitarium is reporting an escaped madman on the loose who killed four people with an axe, and he's located across. They're saying they last saw him down Highway 66, headed towards Corman University, and you know, the girl flips on the lights, and we see that not only is there a sign showing that we are clearly on Route 66, but there's a sign saying Corman University that way, 3 miles. And like, this is the movie we're dropped into. And it's such a record scratch of a narrative moment where we're really going from this is cutting edge 80s stuff and cutting edge 80s camp sliding right into 50s camp.
It is strange in that it is a horror movie that crash lands in the middle of another horror movie.
Yeah.
And by that I mean the two horror movies at first are operating completely independent from one another, because just the madman on the loose, the kind of urban myth, the campfire story that's going on, doesn't need the aliens to crash in to cause it to be a horror story. It already is. And what I love so much about this movie is that kind of encapsulates everything that was going on in 50s horror, was the idea of taking, I mean, this is really, the 50s is really the era where the sci-fi horror film becomes a thing.
Yes.
Because of the atomic age, because of us being afraid of the bomb and the Russians, like all of a sudden science fiction becomes a primary delivery system for horror, whereas previous to that you had a lot of the old gothic stories, a lot of the familiar tales of monsters and you know, the old world being the primary focus of horror, and then all of a sudden the 50s comes along.
And it's aliens.
And it's aliens. So what Fred Dekker is essentially doing with Night of the Creeps is extrapolating that out to a level where he is now nostalgic for, and he's putting his own spin on that story, while at the same time underlying exactly what it was about that era that was changing so much for this genre, was the advent of science fiction, where he literally has his science fiction horror film crash into the middle of a horror story that's already going on and completely change the course of that. And in fact, what happens is that you have this couple that's making out, and they go off to, there's an asteroid that comes down. It's obviously the item that was jettisoned from the spaceship from the beginning. The guy goes to check it out. Something bad happens to her from the maniac. And then you flash forward, like Cargill said, to 1986. This entire time, the horror story from the prologue has been literally kept on ice. I mean, you want to talk about making a literal image out of nostalgia. They have taken that story and that boy who encountered the alien in the capsule, and he is frozen. He is cryogenically frozen. Fred Dekker is literally keeping the 50s sentiment for horror on ice until the 80s, when it is released. And it turns out that what was hiding inside that frozen body was this alien parasite that will get in through your mouth, lay eggs in your brain, and basically make you a zombie until such a time as the offspring of that alien will burst forth from your skull. So it is, in my opinion, the better version of the plan from Plan 9 from Outer Space, which they go so far as to have someone watching in the middle of this film.
And not only have someone watching, they have someone reference,
yes, at the very
back
beginning.
In the opening mm-hmm. sequence. They're like, oh, have you seen Plan 9 from Outer Space? And then we see it later on in the movie. Clearly, this movie is Fred Dekker's version of what if Plan 9 from Outer Space were made by someone competent?
Yes.
What if this movie, and by competent, he's still being campy and deliberately so. There's a number of things here that make no fucking sense.
No.
At all. Like, you know, that just don't make any sense. And it feels deliberately so, because so much of the camp is so well thought out.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred Dekker really was somebody who understood storytelling and knew how to make everything connect, and yet he has these very, very 50s-esque non sequiturs just kind of come out of the blue, and it makes it so entertaining.
Yeah.
It is deliberate camp that is really smart about itself and fun.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting too that as he, the storyteller, the director, has so much nostalgia, and his glasses are firmly rose-colored when it comes to looking at the 50s. The mouthpiece of that era played to absolute perfection by Tom motherfucking Atkins Oh my God, Tom Atkins from Halloween 3, Tom Atkins from The Fog, Tom Atkins, who is everything that is rugged and awesome about the 80s, that character who is directly from that prologue period is the most cynical character in the whole movie. So it's this interesting juxtaposition where Fred Decker, the storyteller, the creator of this world, is so hyper-nostalgic for the 50s, and yet the character that is born of that era, that comes directly from the 50s, within the movie, is the most cynical, downtrodden character. In fact, a very dark character. He's a lot of fun to watch. He's such an asshole. Just an unrepentant asshole to everybody. And yet there's a real, palpable, tragic sadness to him.
Yeah.
And even though that sadness is maybe rooted in the camp of that 50s story, Tom Atkins delivers a lot of gravitas to it. Like, you really feel for this guy and the nightmares that he's having. And as we delve into his past and, like, peel away the layers a little bit, like, it's so incredible to watch his story arc, knowing that even though the creator of this world is so reverent toward the 50s, the character that comes of that era that is meant to be the mouthpiece for the 50s is a cynical, downtrodden, tragic figure.
Yeah.
And I like that juxtaposition.
Yeah, and it's interesting what he's really dealing with. What he's wrestling with here is he's a patrolman who, when he was really young and is, you know, first on the beat, his girlfriend had left him.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want to be married to some small town cop. And is running off and dating some hot stud from college. And she gets killed in that opening sequence by the madman. And we assume through, you know, the magic of flashback dream sequences that Tom Atkins has played some part in killing the madman. And when we find out how it happened, it is even more grisly than we thought. You know, in the dream, you think that he shows up and finds the killer hacking her up. But no, he just showed up and found her.
Yeah.
And then somehow tracked the guy down and killed him and buried him.
And I like the way Decker doles that out, too, is because he gives us a world that is campy enough that we think we know everything because we've seen these movies, right? We've seen Plan 9. We've seen the cheesy sci-fi movies. We've seen movies that are based on urban myths about, you know, teenagers and the morality plays and all that stuff. So we think we're always one step ahead, but the way he deals with Ray Cameron, by the way, Detective Cameron, reference number two, the way he deals with his story and slowly parceling out the details never lets us get to a point where we can kind of be smug about, like, oh, I saw that coming, or I saw that. Like, There is a legitimate element of surprise to that, because what you think he's being haunted by is the death of that girl. What he's actually being haunted by is the aftermath of the death of that girl. So and then when we find out, it's so crazy to me that what you really have in Night of the Creeps is you have several different types of movies operating concordantly, operating at the exact same time. You have, you know, the 50s sci-fi story going on. You have sort of an 80s coming-of-age teen comedy going on. You have a pulp detective story going on with a very haggard, you know, put-upon detective at the end of his rope. You have all of these things going on that I feel like in so many other filmmakers' hands could come off as sloppy or unfocused. But the way that Decker manages all of these really, really works. And it works in the little ways that they start to cross over, and you realize why everything had to be exactly the way that it is and why everything had to exist in the genre that it exists in, so that all the loose ends get tied up the way they do. It actually becomes imperative that Ray Cameron is something of a pulp noir character. It becomes imperative that the beginning of this film is a completely different movie from the 1986 version of this film. You know, like, all of these things work in tandem to make something that, even as it's referencing so many other things, feels like its own unique, you know, story, its own unique filmatic experience.
And then it becomes a weird bridge between the geekdoms. And it's like I was talking about earlier, but there, we've talked about some of the references here. There's one huge reference to the 50s that happens towards the end of the movie. And if junk food cinema could only pick one patron saint, it would be Dick Miller.
It absolutely would be Dick Miller.
It would be Dick Miller, who opens up every show for us. God bless him. We have him record that every week. Every week he sends that in. No, but he appears here as...
Yes, and says it with the exact same inflection. He's the man is a true professional.
He's a true professional. No, but he, you know, he shows up here towards the end of the movie in a classic Dick Miller role. And the scene almost makes no sense because it's a campy 50s movie scene where, you know, the cop shows up and he's like, yeah, I really need to requisition a flamethrower. He goes, a flamethrower? He's like, yeah, hold on a second.
Yeah, and sure, then, a flamethrower.
And he goes back into the back. And, of course, sure enough, the police department has a flamethrower. But it's a little tricky, you know. It's got a problem with the pilot light. You know, very, very Dick Miller-esque dialogue in there. And then, of course, you know, he doesn't have a requisition for him. And that becomes, you know, it almost duplicates the Dick Miller scene from The Terminator to a certain degree.
I was just going to say that. Like, that, I feel like, is why it's so much more classic Dick Miller, is because it's almost the exact same character he played in Terminator.
Yeah, but it's the same character he played so many movies and showed up in so many of these films. And, of course, you know that Decker had to be a huge fan of Dick Miller. So then but here's why it's a weird bridge. There are two other extras in this movie. And one extra that's tied to a weird moment in this movie. There's a moment in this movie where it's one of the classic scenes of this movie. If this movie's got like two truly classic scenes to it. One, of course, is the final sequence at the house with, you know, the great dialogue, final zombie fight. The other is the bathroom sequence when our character CJ's in the bathroom. And there's a moment where he leans forward, an iconic moment in this movie where he leans forward and falls forward and scurries across the bathroom floor. Over his shoulder as he's doing so, this wall is covered in graffiti, and one of the patches of graffiti says, "Go Monster Squad."
Yep.
Now, Monster Squad is a movie released in 1987.
The next year, the year after Night of the Creeps.
The year after Night of the Creeps. Who appears in this movie as one of the cops? Shane Black.
Oh, yeah.
The writer of Monster Squad with Fred Decker. Which Fred Decker would then go on to direct. Another person appearing as an extra in this movie? This weird zombie movie, Greg Nicotero.
Greg Nicotero and Howard Berger, actually.
Yeah. The N and the B from KNB. So, you know, and, you know, they would go on to form KNB and do all these visual effects. But Nicotero would, of course, then go off to make zombie movies for the rest of his life. Like, that's what Nicotero does.
Not to mention working on a television show about zombies that is still on the air.
That he directs episodes every once in a while. And he reportedly directed days on, was it Land of the Dead? That he reportedly, when Romero walked off and he directed for a little bit.
It was either Land of the Dead or Survival of the Dead, but I think it was Land of the Dead.
I want to say it was Land. But so, you know, it's a weird bridge in which we have, you know, Shane Black, who was just starting his career at this point, you know, who'd go on to do, you know, after this, would go on to write Lethal Weapon and Monster Squad and Long Kiss Goodnight.
Last
Boy Scout. And then go on to do Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
As a director.
A film also nostalgic of the 50s. Mm-hmm. And then going on to do Iron Man 3. And then, of course, Nicotero went on to do what he did. Berger went on to, you know, found K&B with Nicotero and do the blood effects for almost all the great indie films of the 90s. So here is this nostalgic film with these young up-and-coming talents that would then be doing nostalgic stuff for the rest of their lives that other people would then get nostalgic for. And it's kind of it's got a very weird place in history where it's got all the bases covered for nerd nostalgia. It's almost like a vortex of nostalgia, mm-hmm. all wrapped up. There's films, there are references in it to stuff that hasn't even happened yet and things that are important in it that won't be cool until much later. And at the same time, it's idolizing and worshiping these cool things beforehand. Like some of the things I was talking about, like there is a non sequitur character who every time we see him, He's eating a sandwich.
Always eating the same sandwich.
And there's a moment where he first walks in and puts down his briefcase, opens the briefcase. There's
the only thing in it.
The only thing in it
is the sandwich.
Is the sandwich. And that character walks around eating a sandwich. Like many terrible characters in old 50s B-movies, the cops are completely inept in that first sequence. Like, they can't even, it's almost like they don't know their dialogue, which is what it's referencing, is the cops in Plan 9 from Outer Space. And they're trying to make sense of it. And that's the thing with Decker, is he makes some sense of it, but he's deliberately riffing on the whole notion of the inept cop. Like, all the cops in this movie are fucking inept as fuck. Like, they cannot drive through the street without not knowing what's going. Like, it really is that kind of old school 50s movie in the 80s when you wouldn't do that with cops. I mean, you and I have covered a number of 80s cops movies that are all about how awesome the cops are.
Yeah.
He's just the fucking opposite.
Yeah, but I think what keeps this from being, because, I mean, when you watch a movie like Plan 9 from Outer Space, you are expected to believe, the movie presupposes you're expected to believe that these cops are real cops in this world. And therefore, yes, they are absolutely inept, but we're like, well, but these are cops. We're forced to kind of swallow the bad acting and the forgotten dialogue, and the ineptitude is just a given. In this film, even though Fred Decker is paying homage to that by having inept cops, he also has a character, again, from the 50s, calling those cops on their shit.
Yes.
And that character is Tom Atkins.
Yeah.
Tom Atkins, Detective Cameron, is the character literally standing there, like, at one point says, well, that's candy ass, but candy ass I can deal with, because he's talking to the cops about how when the first two cops on the scene, this is how I know he's paying homage to terrible cops in the 50s, because there is no other scenario in which this makes sense, where he shows up and the staff sergeant tells him the first two cops on the scene were both rookies and they both went to the bathroom at the same time, so neither of them saw the corpse get up and walk away. The only two cops on the scene both left it untended to go to the bathroom at the exact same time. And Tom Atkins is like, well, that's completely candy ass, but I guess I understand that.
And then at the same time, so we've talked about the 50s-ness of it. This movie's 80s as fuck.
It couldn't be more 80s if Oingo Boingo had done the entire soundtrack and it was filmed through a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, instead of Oingo Boingo, who was it? Wall of Voodoo?
Yeah, I remember we were watching it and I was like, wait a minute. Is that Wall of Voodoo? Did they find a second song by Wall of Voodoo that isn't Mexican radio? Bravo, Fred Decker. I didn't think that existed.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's such an 80s movie. The female characters are completely inept and almost worthless.
Mm-hmm.
But every time they need to get ready for something, we get to see them take their clothes off.
Yep.
We have a non sequitur camera shot tracking across the bathroom of a number of girls taking showers who are supposed to be sorority girls who are clearly in their mid to late 20s.
Whoa. Are you suggesting the nudity in this film is gratuitous?
I am suggesting that it's gratuitous as fuck.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It totally is. It's absolutely gratuitous.
Yeah, it's it hits all the 80s notes. It's got the douchebag bully.
Oh my god, the douchiest, possibly the douchiest of douchebag bullies.
Yeah, you know, he's not the most detestable of douchebag bullies. He's just the douchiest. Like, he is the Draco Malfoy of fucking 80s college bullies.
Yeah.
You just want to punch him in the face. And as you were mentioning earlier, he's robotic as fuck.
He looks like somebody programmed one of the Rockafire explosion like animatronics to just recite 80s bullies-isms.
Yeah.
Because he's just like, okay, babe, all right.
Well, hey, babe, how you doing?
Moves his head back and forth.
Oh,
like,
the kid with crutches, with a, you know, the handicapped kid just made fun of me. I'm going to trip his crutch. Huh.
Oh, hey, babe. If I knew you were going to get bent out of shape about it, I wouldn't have told you. It's just like every time he speaks, you can almost see his collar just turning itself up and then getting higher and higher and higher.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And plus,
he looks like Arian Christopher Walken. So there's that.
There is that. And also, this movie's made in 1986, which is just before the mullet takes over,
yeah,
and at the end of the coolness of the mustache. So like, see, that's the thing is I was watching this and you were like, at one point you're like, oh, look, all the bullies' dads showed up.
It does. In one scene, they're like confronted by the quote unquote bully frat. And I'm like, are these the frat brothers or their dads? Because they all look like they're 40.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because I was sitting there, I was going, oh, man, this reminds me. I'm so glad that I was just the right age to be just too young to ever have a mustache during that period of time. I missed the mustache and I'm like, yeah, we didn't have anything like that. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, I totally didn't have a goatee in high school. I don't have those pictures to look back on and cringe at. Yeah, we didn't have the mullet either. Fuck. So I had a mullet and a goatee, and I was glad that I missed out on the fucking mustache.
Yeah, thank God you dodged that bullet.
Yeah, really
sidestepped that landmine, Cargill.
Oh, boy. Yeah, oh boy. So, but yeah, but it's like, it's all these kids right in, you know, freshmen in college with mustaches that all look like they're 30.
Yeah.
And it feels very, very, very 1986. Like there's just, it could not have looked or felt a few years younger or a few years older. Like it is such a movie of that moment that you look back and you're like, that's as 1986 as it gets.
Yeah.
It is really kind of crazy. So it's a very hip movie for its time. Playing around with a hip idea and a hip take on something that's not hip, because zombie movies were dead in 1986.
Ba-dum.
Yes.
They were undead.
They were undead. No, because they would have to rise every once in a while. Like, this is the period of time where Day of the Dead had already come out, and it didn't do well, and zombie movies were over. We're done with zombie movies.
This was just, 1986... This would have been a couple years prior to Return of the Living Dead, correct?
No. It's just after Return of the Living Dead.
Oh, just after Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah, no. As okay. Return of the Living Dead Part 2 but would come out in 87. But the Return of the Living Dead movies are so riffing on that. It's nostalgic in the same way where they, you know, they open the first Return of the Living Dead with, hey kids, did you ever see that movie Night of the Living Dead? Well, it turns out it's true. So, you know, it's, and that movie, and that's Clue Gulager doing that, which is kind of delightful.
So this movie should have started with Clue Gulager being like, hey kid, you ever see that movie Plan 9 from Outer Space?
First of all, every movie should start out with Clue Gulager. That is just a thing.
You
that
heard it here
happen.
First.
Because Clue Gulager is fucking awesome.
Clue, if you're out there, buddy, hit us up. We would love to have you on the show.
But
if you're one of our 8 listeners, we'd really appreciate
yes,
hearing from you.
If it's you and 7 other people. but it's that kind of, like, nobody was making serious zombie movies. Mm-hmm. You know, we would get another goofy one a short while later with Dead Alive several years after, which steals a gag from this movie.
It totally does. I remember I was watching this. I was like, huh, so they're also referencing Dead Alive. And then you were like, no, that came out after this. And
6 years.
Sure enough,
this.
That's right. So,
well, no, Dead Alive is famously a movie that several people in the industry at the time were really upset about. I know that I've heard that Sam Raimi was not a fan because he felt that it ripped off the Evil Dead movies something awful. So it ripped off the Evil Dead movies and Night of the Creeps and did its own amazing things because Peter Jackson's fucking great and I fucking love Dead Alive. But yeah, he totally stole the lawnmower gag. But in true horror fashion, he did up the ante. Because sure. Instead of just running over one guy with a lawnmower, he then, you know, mows through a whole army of zombies in Dead Alive with a lawnmower. And I'm not going to, you know, kick someone in the balls for, you know, a lawnmower gag. I'm just saying that if there was anybody in this room that could make fun of somebody killing people with lawnmowers,
yeah,
I would not be the guy.
I don't know if gag is the right word, because as hilarious as I found that moment in Sinister, I'm not sure it was supposed to be funny. I think that's really more of a reflection on me as a human being. But let's talk for a minute about the three main characters of this film.
I'm sorry. I don't like referencing my own work on this show, but I realized as I was getting deeper and deeper into talking about lawnmower gags that somebody out there was going to call me on it.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So I do apologize.
So our main three characters, Chris Romero, James Carpenter Hooper, and Cynthia Cronenberg. Okay, come on.
Cronenberg.
Come on. And in fact, with the first... the first of the human incubator zombies that we see in this movie, when the slugs burst out of his head, it leaves what looks like a vagina on his face. And I was like, oh, there's another Cronenberg reference. But so these three characters, these are our main three characters. And we were talking about the basic dynamic here is that Chris and JC are our best friends, and Chris is in love with Cynthia.
They are the betaist of beta males.
And what is the name of the fraternity they're trying to join?
Beta.
There you go. But
and you say in love with Cynthia. This is the classic 80s trope.
She's pretty, so I want to spend
she's
the rest of my life with
standing
her.
Standing across the street, and he sees her and decides, I am in love with her.
Yeah.
I don't know her name. We've never spoken. She may not actually have a personality, but I'm in love.
Yes.
And then as it turns out, his beta friend is who is crippled is actually alpha as fuck.
He is hilarious. He is like Willie Ames to the nth degree. He is...
Except not for himself. He is
exactly
if Willie Ames was an alpha trying to get Charles laid all the time.
He is a selfless alpha.
That is who he would be.
He's the most noble of alphas imaginable. And I kind of want to talk about that, about the choice, which I think is pretty unique and bold, to have a character, the best friend character, not only have a physical disability, but despite that, be the far more confident character than our hero.
Yeah. Well, and then.
And the funnier character. And in fact, the character with way more personality than either of the two people in the romantic relationship.
Any of the characters in the movie. Like, he, at the end of the day, like, even Tom Atkins, like, at the end of the day, he has. This guy is chock full of personality. Mm-hmm. Like, he gets a slug in the mouth and realizes what's going on and selflessly goes and sets himself up to potentially die.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that nobody else. He doesn't get anybody else.
Well, it's very samurai. I mean, it's essentially self-immolation is what he's doing.
But the one issue, as bold as this choice is, it's still, he's still a crippled guy who is a relatively attractive guy, mm-hmm. Who's alpha as fuck and is like, no girl's ever going to want me, so I may as well get my friend laid. But it's kind of also playing around with the idea that maybe he's not heterosexual.
Yeah. I remember as we were watching the movie tonight, I remember you saying that the more interesting relationship would have been JC and Cynthia, and then as we were watching I was like, I think the more interesting relationship would have been Chris and JC.
Well, yeah, and there's actually that moment where they actually kind of joke around with that, where that's where this comes from. This isn't one of those, you know, Frodo and Sam things where we're like, I don't know, Sam kind of loves Frodo, this is kind of gay. No, this is, there's a whole big joking scene that is exactly the way that in the closet gay guys end up joking around with their heterosexual friends they're attracted to.
You could say it's how they end up joking each other off.
Or you could not say that. You could do one of those two things. You could say that, or you could not say that. I'm staying firmly in the not say that.
That camp. Silence you just heard was every bit as uncomfortable in the room as it was listening to it at home. So enjoy that. This episode brought to you by beer.
And Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
We're building a wall across gayness and getting the gay men to pay for it.
I'm just saying, instead of acting upon these feelings that you have for your same-sex buddy, you just make jokes about it. And you
which
you
is actually a, yes, no, it's a very, it is a very, very normal thing. And that's what, when that happens, it's kind of like, because, you know, this is the first time I've seen this in a long time. I saw this when it first came out. And didn't connect with it at the time because I was too young to really appreciate the nostalgia of it.
Sure.
And the goofiness of it didn't make sense because it really is something of an in-joke at many times. Like, there's the biggest non-sequitur in this movie, the frustrating moment that you really have to kind of consciously wrap your head around is why all of a sudden this zombie under the ground, underneath this house, chooses the moment that all the other zombies are running around to kind of burst through the floor. Like, there is no mechanic described in the movie that makes that make sense.
What Cargo's referring to is that, as we referenced before, Ray Cameron tracks down the axe murderer that killed his girlfriend in the 50s and murders that axe murderer, buries him behind the sorority house. Now, in the 80s, they end up building on that land the house mother's cottage. and it turns out that's where he buried it. So it ends up coming up from underneath the floor. And here's my question, not why did it choose that moment? Why did he bury it with the goddamn axe still in its hand?
Well,
because it's just there. It's just like, hey, I've still got my axe. It seems like a bad idea.
Because he didn't think it was going to come back to life.
Well,
like,
that
was no part of his narrative at that point.
If you are from the 50s, you should understand that that's a possibility because of atomic bombs.
But the thing is that all the other zombies happening at once all make sense because they come from this, you know, this the original body that was taken out of cryofreeze. But this other body just comes out of the floor and just murders someone with an axe so that Tom Atkins can face down his, you know, the zombie version of his nemesis again. But at the same time, it's not supposed to make sense.
No.
Because the movie it's ripping on doesn't make a lick of goddamn sense and has moments like that occur all throughout. Plan 9, of course, for those of you that haven't seen Plan 9.
Oh, it's a treat.
Quite some time heralded. It was for years considered, all through the 80s and 90s, considered to be the worst movie ever made. Consistently, Ed Wood was voted the worst director of all time, which is how we got the movie Ed Wood. If you've never seen Ed Wood for some reason, dear God, watch Ed Wood and then watch Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Truth.
But now there's a certain reverence for Ed Wood and a glorious, ironic enjoyment of it rather than a detestment that we had for so long.
Well, and I think it's been diluted a lot, too, by extra theatrical release platforms where it's like you can have so many movies that aren't released in theaters that are every bit as bad as Plan 9. But the really insulting, crazy thing about Plan 9 is that it was released in theaters.
Yeah.
I think that is the difference. But yes, making so many references to Plan 9 and all these movies of the 50s, there is that moment, like Cargo said, where the axe murderer's body, basically its own type of zombie, comes out of the ground. But I will say, when they track it down and blow its head off, it has the slug. What it's missing is one shot of the slug slithering up toward that house mother's cottage. It's missing
slithering
that,
underground.
Right. It's missing that insert shot because when they track down the zombified axe murderer and blow its head off, and by they I of course mean Ray Cameron because Tom Atkins is a badass and credit where credit is due, the slugs come out of it.
Yeah.
So it's trying to play up the idea that it's related, but again, we're missing that shot that kind of connects the dots there. But I want to say one thing. We mentioned before that playing zombie extras in this movie are Nicotero and Berger. The effects in this film still hold up remarkably well.
Oh, God, yeah. No, like, the zombie effects are typical zombie effect stuff. But the slugs, the zombie cat, the zombie dog, they're genuinely creepy and fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, really well-done stuff. Which makes me wonder how much Nicotero and Berger may have had to do with it.
One wonders why else they would be on set for this playing zombie extras. I mean, two guys who would go on to form one of the sort of preeminent gore effects houses in the world happen to be working together just as extras on this film. Like, there has to be more to that story than we're hearing. But I also want to, like, I think the effect that freaks me out the most is the one we've just been talking about. Is the reanimated corpse of the axe murderer, because that thing is the way it moves. The sort of interstitial cutting between what is obviously a puppet effect and what's an actor in makeup is really, really frightening. And again, just even by today's standards, holds up so well being completely practical. And I really dug that. And I also love, by the way, when you get to the end of this film, if you own the Blu-ray or the DVD that have come out in the last few years, you are going to be seeing footage that, keep in mind, was not released in theaters. There's sort of a two-part epilogue to this movie that was not part of the theatrical ending. The first is that we have, you know, spoiler alerts for anyone who hasn't seen the film, but like we've said before, you should really start watching these films ahead of time. That's why we tell you ahead of time what we're talking about. The ending of this film is another sacrificial noble moment, this time from Ray Cameron, Tom Atkins' character, who stays in the basement to light the gas main and blow up the nest of slugs that will hopefully take them all out. Now, the original ending of this film apparently was just Chris and Cynthia standing in front of the burning down sorority house. What the DVD and Blu-ray add back into it, the original ending, is that we then see a charred animated corpse of Ray Cameron walking out of the house. He falls over, the slugs burst out of his skull, and they slither into a cemetery.
Yep.
So immediately one's mind goes to Plan 9 again, goes to Night of the Living Dead. But right as you think you figured out, oh, that's the ending they're going for, all of a sudden a spotlight comes down, and that spaceship from the beginning of the movie is searching for these slugs, adding a sort of bookend to what we've seen, you know, as the prologue of the film, now repeated with the epilogue. And I really like the way this movie ends. And I'm kind of surprised that neither of those codas that we just mentioned were part of the original theatrical ending. Yeah. Neither one of them. So, I mean,
well, it strikes me as one of those things where, because when you're in a situation where you're working on a story, you're working on a film, mm-hmm. you've shot stuff, maybe you've written stuff, but you haven't quite shot stuff, and you've got notes you're dealing with, you end up trying to analyze what it is you've come up with. And maybe it was one of those things where he didn't realize just how much he had aped Plan 9 from Outer Space. And that kind of thing happens. I remember talking to Neil Marshall about his movie Centurion and his movie
Doomsday,
and saying, oh, you made two movies about the wall and trying to get back across the wall from enemy territory. He just kind of looked at me. He's like, oh, shit. Yeah, no, I did. And it just had never dawned on him that he had made, you know, that he had deliberately, that story had was so close twice, mm-hmm. because they had such radically different things that was just a small element of the story. And maybe it was one of those cases where Fred Decker wasn't deliberately making a Plan 9 thing, and somewhere along the way, he or someone else is like, you know, we've pretty much remade Plan 9, only better. And when they needed to come up with that additional stuff, it was like, oh, hey, I've got an idea. What if we went full Plan 9? What if we reference Plan 9 at the end? You know, what if we go there?
Yeah.
So that's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, it very well could be. I like the bookends of the alien ship because, you know, as we were watching it tonight, I think you mentioned that the very beginning, the prologue of this movie feels like the opening of Critters.
Yeah. And no. In fact, I always mistook this scene in my brain. This scene was the opening scene from Critters. And it was, and when I were watching it, I was like, oh shit, no, this was from Night of the Creeps, not Critters. I always had associated this scene with Critters. And it's very similar to the scene in Critters, but this is the scene with the big dopey guys, the big marshmallow alien guys.
Yeah.
Was from this one. And it was just like, oh shit, that's right. That's how this movie opens.
Yeah. And I like that because that scene at the beginning is one of those distinctly 80s moments in the film. Even a film that is so entrenched in 50s nostalgia still opens with a very distinctly, like, there is nothing 50s styled about that ship or those aliens. That ship, you know what that ship looks like, is the goddamn Nostromo.
Yeah.
Which, again, like Ray Cameron, I don't think it's a stretch to say that he might have borrowed from Alien a little bit.
Sergeant Raimi.
There's a Sergeant Raimi in this. But yeah, so the opening of this film could not possibly be more 80s, and then immediately, and this is again what I love about it so much about that juxtaposition, is that it begins with a scene that, even with its science fiction trappings, is distinctly 80s, and then literally jettisons that, injects it into the 1950s. And that's exactly what this film is.
Yeah.
Is he's blasting a 1980s mentality into a nostalgia for the 1950s. And that's the whole reason the movie opens that way. And to me, that's the reason I love the fact that it ends that way too, with a movie that, you know, the whole 1986 half of this movie, or I guess it's really more of a two-thirds situation, and that big finale, like, everything feels so distinctly 80s. And then when it starts to slither into the cemetery, and you're reminded once again about Plan 9 from Outer Space, and then you see the spaceship, it adds this perfect little cherry on the sundae, because it's reminding you of the 50s while also slapping you in the face with what is distinctly 80s about this film. And that weird porridge works so well in this film and makes it distinctly entertaining. And like I said, the effects still hold up. And I honestly think that as arguably one-dimensional as some of these characters are in reference to, you know, the 50s style that it's aping, they're really engaging, a lot of them. And I like we talked about before, JC's death in this movie is so moving.
Yeah.
And the sacrifice that he makes, and you're rooting as wooden as Chris can be at times, you're still rooting for him. And, you know, Cynthia is tragically an 80s heroine, so there's not much.
There's not even much. She doesn't even get much dialogue, which is really like.
And yet she still has moments where, like, there's one great moment where she shoves a flamethrower into a zombie's eye and turns it on and blows up the head of the fucking zombie.
The final sequence when she finally snaps out of being an 80s heroine,
yeah,
and wakes up and is actually an 80s hero. And our 80s hero is kind of a little bitch while his girl kind of shows him what's up. But up until that point, she's such an 80s character. Like, I was noticing, like, she had like maybe six or seven lines of dialogue before we've seen her topless.
Yeah.
Like, she's been in a number of scenes. She just hasn't been the one talking, yeah, because she was a girl in the 80s and that's what you did. Right. Because misogyny, it was awesome.
And yet, what is her last line in this movie? This is what I love about this, because it turns misogyny on its ear in a certain way.
Yeah.
Because her last line in the movie, in fact, the last spoken line of dialogue in the whole movie, is she adjusts his tie and says, "Nice suit." Like, "Hey, nice suit." Which is such like a, if you flip those around and he had like brushed her hair behind her ear and said, "You look really pretty," or something, like, that would have been so much more the typical 80s sort of finisher, with him looking tough and, like, you know, making her swoon and you know, being that kind of like, "Oh, you're still really pretty," and like, that matters. But she does it to him.
And yet, at the same time, it's still the classic trope of he gets the girl, she's the reward.
That's true.
Like, I mean, it tries to have its cake and eat it too. It's like, hey, feminism, awesome, but we're still playing by boys' club rules.
Yeah.
And but, you know, it's 1986. But it is 30 years ago.
It does,
and
also,
it's kind of what the audience wanted at the point.
But it also murders an entire busload of the most horribly bromantic frat brothers you have ever seen a film. It delights.
Like, hey, remember what they did in Revenge of the Nerds? Wait till you see what we do.
Seriously.
Here.
Oh, you thought beating them in a musical competition and burning down their frat house was bad? We straight up gleefully murder a busload of dude bros in this film. And like,
then bring them back to life so we can burn
do it
them again.
So we can fucking kill Steve the Unibrow with a lawnmower after we've killed him in a bus crash. Like, this movie has no love for frat brothers
none,
at all.
None.
Oh, it's so, so glorious.
It's so wantonly 80s.
Yes, it is.
I mean, that's just, and that's the thing about this movie. It's so entrenched in its time while being in love with another time. It's such a weird time capsule, and I'm fascinated by it because it really is a movie that reaches out in two different directions to touch two different genres of films and filmmakers, and then has, you know, a 50s icon, you know, genre icon, and, you know, this era genre icon. It's just so crazy and awesome and weird and delightful.
Yeah. And like I said before, the character of the sort of jock from the 50s that encounters the meteorite that is then, you know, revealed to be a cryogenically frozen underneath the university is so fitting, so apropos to what this movie is. And like you said, it's a time capsule. It is taking the love of 50s cinema and putting it on ice and then thawing it out in an era where an entirely new type of horror film had emerged, an entirely new sensibility had become the norm, and watching those two things sort of struggle to gain a foothold and ultimately walking together just is what is so fantastic about Night of the Creeps.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I want to share my other kind of 50s joke moment that I absolutely love. Like, everybody, you know, with this movie, there's two things that get quoted, and they're both Atkins quotes.
Yep.
You know, it's "Thrill Me." Yep. And then
the good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Yeah. So, but my favorite moment from this movie is early on when they find the cryogenically frozen dude. CJ, or JC, he looks down, he's like, oh, it's a cryogenic containment system. And you know, Chris is like, what? And he's like, don't you know what this cryogenic is? No. Well, it's like where we freeze somebody. It's like we turn somebody, you know, it's like, you know, freeze-dried food. Well, it's like a freeze-dried people. And then he just goes, you mean like suspended animation? It's like, it's such a 50s dialogue exposition line. Yeah, yeah. It's like, I'm not following what you're saying, so I'm going to throw an even bigger sci-fi concept at you. It's like, yes, it's exactly like that. Of course, because that's what it is.
Offset immediately by the 80s joke, he's a corpsicle.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's just back and forth. It's ping-ponging between the ears, even within its dialogue.
Look, these are the people that brought us Wolfman's Got Nards.
That's true. You know,
that's the thing, is that his next movie would be even more fucking nostalgic than this, where this is a love letter to 50s B cinema. You know, his next movie would be a love letter to 30s and 40s A level horror cinema.
Yep. Yep.
He would start playing with Dr. Acula or Alucard. That's what it was.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's like a continuum. It makes me wonder, had RoboCop 3 not completely, and in my opinion, savagely unfairly derailed the career of Fred Dekker, how far back along that continuum he would have continued to go? Because if his first film is a love letter to the 50s, his second film is a love letter to the 30s, like, where do you go from there? You know, and I really would have loved to have seen what Fred Dekker would have done. And I'm so excited to find out that he is,
I think in the late 90s, yeah, he would have done his Grindhouse movie.
Oh, I'm sure. But now he and Shane Black are reuniting, thankfully, to do a Western series for Amazon.
Oh, it's on Amazon now, yeah.
Oh, it is? Oh, I can't wait to check that out, because that when I heard that announced, I was like, oh my God, this is like a gift just for me to hear that Shane Black and Fred Dekker are reuniting and working on anything.
Reunited, and it feels so good.
Zombies, exploding heads, creepy crawlies. We could have a little problem.
Well, you know what I think?
What do you think?
I think it's time that we get on to the junk food pairing.
The junk food pairing! And yeah, this was, until we started this episode, I wasn't sure, but as soon as we started talking, it is absolutely a no-brainer that Night of the Creeps junk food pairing will be a crepe. So have your own Night of the Crepes. And you know what? Here's the thing about a crepe.
Tell me about a crepe.
A crepe is something there are so many different versions of it, and there are so many different iterations depending on what you put inside of it. You can put fruit in there, you can put something savory, you can put cookies, you can put ice cream.
When I was in London, one of my favorite restaurants in Richmond was a small privately owned French restaurant that specialized in crepes and had an entire side of the menu dedicated to just all the stuff they would put in a crepe for you. It was amazing.
And that's what Fred Dekker has done. He has stuffed this particular crepe with all of the different references.
Lots of cheese.
So much cheese.
So much cheese.
A dash of 80s mentality, a dash of rosy red nostalgia sauce to just coat the top of it. I mean, he's really like put everything he loves into this one containment system, and he is delivering it with all of the syrupy goodness of something like a crepe.
And yet it's like a crepe. It's also light.
Yeah.
This is not a heavy meal of a movie.
Not at all.
This is a very light, tasty treat.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's what I highly advise you do. If you don't own this, go out and buy the Blu-ray of Night of the Creeps. Get all of the accoutrement to make yourself some crepes and have a Night of the Creeps, Night of the Crepes.
Night of the Crepes.
Night of the Crepes.
Night of the Crepes.
Thank you so much for joining us for this week's Junk Food Cinema. If you would like to hear more of us, our catalog is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on facebook.com/massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Twitter at twitter.com/massaworm.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And definitely keep coming back. We're going to be announcing our next slate of junk food titles here coming up, so stay tuned for that, because definitely want to give you guys a chance to watch these movies before we dig into them so that you're not spoiled, even as we spoil you with lots of information and insights and all that good stuff. And just tell everyone you know about junk food cinema. We would really appreciate that. But That is going to do it, and we want to end this show on a poignant note. So I'm just going to remind you that
if you scream, you're dead.